This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And welcome to this week's show. Tonight's guest is Richard Craner. Am I saying your last name right?
Yes.
All absolutely. Right. Yeah. And you have made a rather interesting movie called?
Starling.
Okay. You want to tell people a little bit about this?
Yeah. Starleaf is a kind of, like you said, it's a very interesting original film. It's basically something that a lot of people don't think would come together, which is aliens and marijuana. And yes, it sounds silly, and it has it's silly for sure. But it was more about how I think our consciousness and our understanding of consciousness is deeply naive right now. And the basic premise is that two Marines who come back from Afghanistan are looking for a cure to their PTSD. And they hear about this alien marijuana growing in the Olympic Mountains of Washington State. So they go on a little journey to find it. And when they find it, the reason they want it is because it functions similarly to like an ayahuasca type experience. It's extraterrestrial marijuana, so it has that extra punch that can cure their PTSD, or so they're told. They find it, they steal it, all hell breaks loose, and from there things just get pretty crazy. But it was all sort of based upon some experiences I've had and some issues that I think are really important right now with medical cannabis and just in general how we're going to deal with all these big issues we face right now without really understanding, you know, all the, I think, opportunities to expand our consciousness that this planet gives us.
Fair enough. I actually enjoyed the movie a great deal. I mean, it is a low-budget film.
Yeah.
But it is very unique. It's very original. And it was fun. It really was. It was a fun, enjoyable watch. You didn't know exactly where it was going. It wasn't predictable because you're not, you know, being constrained by the rules of Hollywood, where you have to have this and you have to have that, and you can't do this and you can't do that. You were able to do what you wanted to do, and you know, I always appreciate that in independent films. There's so much more creativity there.
Yes.
Hollywood has next to none at this point.
No, exactly. I had a guy give me a great compliment the other day. He said, "You know, the three leads in your film, they were good looking and engaging, but they weren't like that crap we get now in Hollywood where everyone is so beautiful and unrelatable and just ridiculous. Like, there's just no way half these hot chicks that are in the Regent films and the Mockingbird, whatever they're called, they're just not going to be out there fighting and looking that good while they're doing it."
Well, so sure. Kind of,
I think we've ran into a problem in Hollywood now where it's almost you can't believe the movies you're watching because you just don't relate to any of the people, really, you know. So it's kind of one of the nice things about being a low budget. I got to choose whoever I wanted to, you know?
Yeah. And you have one of the guys who stars in Z Nation in this.
Yeah. Yeah. Russell Hodgkinson. He's a great actor. He's a great guy. And he just had that character from day one. I wrote his part for him personally, cause I had already met him a couple of times. So he's just the guy, you know?
And he doesn't play a completely different part than he does on Z Nation either.
Yeah. No, it's similar, yeah.
It fits him really well.
Yeah, yeah. Some people think it's Willie Nelson. Some people think it's Tommy Chong in my movie. I tell them it's both combined is what it kind of is.
Yeah, it is kind of. I never thought of him that way, but yeah. Right. He doesn't play a huge role in it. He's kind of in the beginning and at the end.
Yeah, yeah. He because, you know, he was busy shooting Z Nation, so I can only use him for – I think he only came out for one weekend. I think we literally shot all of his scenes in 2 days. He was too busy out there in Spokane getting chasing zombies or being chased by zombies.
And this is, you know, when you say aliens, it's not like there are UFOs or anything in this. It is part of a consciousness shift they experience after doing this drug.
Yeah, that was a tricky thing because my distributor kept asking me to slap a giant UFO on the cover of this thing.
Sure.
And I kept saying there's no UFOs. He's like, well, wait, you got aliens, but where are the UFOs? I'm like, well, it's more complicated than that. He's like, just shut up, you know.
And
no one cares.
Before we go any further, where is this available for people?
If you want, you can go on Google Play, iTunes. The DVD is on Amazon. Family Video in the United States, I think the only big remaining DVD or video store carries it. And I think we're coming to Hulu and Amazon Prime within a month or two.
Nice. And the name of it again?
Star Leaf, as in space weed, basically.
Star Leaf. All right. So let's. One of the things you told me is that part of the inspiration from this came from, was it your brother having PTSD?
Yeah. Yeah, it really kind of all started. A lot of my writing the last couple of years started when my brother came back from Iraq. I got in a call from my mother in the middle of the night saying that he had tried to kill himself and he was on a lot of different drugs. And so basically I talked to him and I tried to help him coordinate some VA gymnastics to get him treatment. But it just hit home, you know, because so many of these guys are coming back and the infrastructure we have in the United States to deal with them is poor. And not only that, our whole society's take on what trauma is and how to fix it is I think deeply flawed. So it mirrored my own encounters with PTSD and issues with it. And, you know, it just sort of opened up the Pandora's box for me and forced me to think about a way in which I could create something that's a piece of art that would at least draw some attention to it and maybe inspire more of a journey for other people to go down a similar road and try to get some answers.
Now, did you have PTSD yourself?
Yeah, I mean, it's just something that I inherited from my own childhood. I also had a pretty bad bout with cancer that tripped me up pretty good. I don't want to say that my Kundalini experiences gave me PTSD, but they definitely they definitely threw me for such a big loop that, you know, I had to kind of find some kind of some answers, you know, and so it's all of this has been about a bigger journey for me and understanding what causes consciousness to do what it does and what why are we here and why do we suffer? And because that suffering that he was going through and I've gone through and everybody goes through is also some kind of trigger to like go deeper if we can manage it. But not everybody can manage it. Not our society can't manage it in general. But the film is about this concept. Well, actually, I don't think it's a concept. I think it's a fundamental reality of our universe, that there's this mechanism in the universe that wants us to keep going despite all this. And it provides us plant allies. It provides us other avenues of exploration that I think we need to encounter more in our everyday lives.
Yeah, yeah, and as you said in the beginning, even though this is supposed to be space weed, it functions very much like ayahuasca does.
Yes, yeah, pretty much. You know, I just think that I haven't used ayahuasca myself, but I've had similar ayahuasca type experiences with Kundalini, and you know, I just know that for most people, they're not going to be able to get past their conscious mind without a little help, and that's why I think these plants do. They open up a portal almost, you know, to this other aspect of the universe that your rational, analytical mind doesn't have the capacity to encompass. So whether it's meditation that does it for you, whether it's other types of experiences you have, or whether you're taking certain plants, I think it's all important in some way because you have to get around your mind in some way, your thinking mind. Not that you have to abandon all critical thought. I think that's really important as well, but the first door in, you got to jump in the deep end in some ways, you know, to get the truth, you know, that comes from these other locations.
Yeah, no, and I would agree. As Graham Hancock says, there's sort of a war on consciousness in our culture.
Absolutely.
And the war on drugs is kind of a part of it. I mean, there's certainly bad drugs out there like heroin and cocaine that generally aren't going to do anything good for you, but there's also positive drugs out there that can help that are totally natural and they're very illegal.
Yeah, I mean, methamphetamines, I wouldn't recommend anybody doing meth.
Right.
I mean, the Nazis gave us meth, so that's not a good starting point. But like you said, you know, these plants, they're part of the same, we all share the same, you know, carbon and genetics, and it's part of who we are, I think. And when you're fighting this war on consciousness, you're trying to keep us and keep people from having different trains of thought, you know, and that's not good.
All right, let's get into a little bit of your experiences. People have listened to this show for a while, know I've had a lot of experiences with Kundalini, but let's hear about yours.
I kind of want to hear yours sometime too. I wasn't really expecting it to happen. I like I said, I had my childhood and whatnot was pretty rough. And I think I just spent, I've been a seeker most of my life. And when I was about 25 or so, 26, 27, those years, I started meditating a lot. And I didn't really have any plans. I didn't really know what it was going to do. At some point, though, around my 29th birthday, I started spontaneously moving. Like I would wake up and my hand would be at night. It would just be making these weird sign language, you know. And I guess they're called mudras now. I learned what they were. And my girlfriend was like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "I don't know." My hand just decided by itself to start sign language to something that I don't know what it's talking to. And then the tough part was that one day I was coming home and I started spontaneously chanting some language that I didn't know what it was. And my girlfriend's like, "Stop, shut up." And I'm like, "I can't. I don't know what's happening." And she Googled the words that I was saying, and they were like these Hindu Bij mantras. They were like Sanskrit prayers. And then I really shit my pants. Sorry, I'm not supposed to cuss. Sorry, my bad. I really lost it. You know, I just for the next 5 to 10 years, these types of things would spontaneously happen to me, where I would just uncontrollably do yoga or some form of mudras. I'd speak string languages, and I had the worst. I don't know how to describe it. Like the worst feelings of just my body, and my soul being torn apart. I don't know how to describe it in words. It was just being on the precipice of like death and insanity. And it would cycle. It wasn't always like that. But that happened a lot. A couple out-of-body experiences happened. I had a reincarnation flashback where I got my head cut off in a past life.
Nice.
It was really intense. And I can only say that maybe within the last year or two has most of that calmed down. It seems like it's processed, you know. But when it finished, it sort of left me with this, I guess, this desire to try to make some kind of art out of all of it.
Hmm. Did you were you doing Kundalini yoga at the time?
No. Eventually, what happened to me is when I started looking at my phenomena, it mirrored exactly what Kundalini yoga does. The Kundalini yoga mantras, Kundalini yoga mudras, they're all the same things I was doing, but I'd never taken Kundalini yoga. And my guru, what happened is I went to the hospital within like the first week. I went to the Virginia Mason ER. And I asked them, "Do you know what's happening?" And they're like, "You're not trying to kill yourself. You're not trying to kill anybody else. So get out of here. You know, the bed's got to be saved for the real crazies. We don't know what's going on, but we think you'll be okay. Here you go." So I'm like, "Okay, great. That didn't help." And then I went to a Buddhist monastery because I figured this stuff looked pretty Asian. And you guys have to know what this is. And they're like, "I'm sorry, we don't know." then I kept Googling the things I was saying. And I was saying like the Hom, Hum, Cream, Shreem, all these like Bij mantras. They're not even like the normal mantras. They're Bij mantras, which are – they're just like consciousness anchors is what they call them, I guess, in Sanskrit terminology. But eventually this – I kept getting Kundalini this, Kundalini that. I'm like, what the heck is Kundalini? And then I found a guru who lived locally. It was very, very serendipitous. And for 2 or 3 years, I just would go to her and she would give me help. You know, she tried to clear – the blockages so they wouldn't be so intense. And eventually, you know, we went through our little period together where she helped ground the experiences so that I could get my head wrapped around. Because I thought I was being possessed. I thought I'd done something really bad. You know, I grew up a hardcore Jehovah's Witness.
Mm.
So there was a lot of conflict, you know, with this, what was a positive spiritual experience coming up against a lot of ingrained Judeo-Christian prejudice and just fear and lack of control. I don't like not being in control of what my body's doing. My body starts speaking Sanskrit. It's worrisome. But then I found out some very fascinating things. I found out that, you know, NASA has been using Sanskrit for a long time because Sanskrit's it's a mathematically perfect language. And there's a lot of interesting connections between what they're doing with artificial intelligence now and Sanskrit. It seems to me like And I don't think even these Bij mantras are like classical Sanskrit. They're like just, they're like what they call, I guess you call a meme, just something that's beyond a semantic meaning, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting because it's all about vibration and anchoring and sort of almost like tuning in to deeper layers of the psyche. And I think the language of Sanskrit was just something that was a natural extension of our being for a long time. And it's derived into all these other languages. And a lot of those ancient languages share that same... If you go back to the ancient languages, they all have layers. They're not just semantic representations of concepts. Some of them have numerical meanings. Some of them have like other things beyond just the syllables themselves. So it was just fascinating to go through all that. And I feel now that I'm still probably a very active Kundalini, but it's sort of discharged a lot of the big blocks.
Mm. Did you ever have any incidences with like electronics going nuts around you?
Yes, you know, that happens still. And the other thing that the Kundalini did is it gave me some sort of psychic ability. It's not an ability that I can control in any way. I really don't have any. I've tried to go to the casino and use it, and I failed. I succeeded once. I fail most of the time when I try to do it. But it allows me to at times notice patterns, and it's led to some very phenomenal incidents. And the one thing that's really weird about it is it's left me open to the ability I get to smell what I think are negative entities. And that's the weirdest thing for me, because I don't have a particularly good sense of smell to begin. And it's just something that I've noticed happening a lot in the last maybe a couple years. And it's really led me to really believe that what we call aliens or demons or whatever, I don't know what all the categories are, and I can't claim to know specifics, but I definitely know that what we call intelligence, I don't think is limited to biology or carbon matter. I think from what I've experienced, consciousness is something that, you know, incarnates in some way in space-time and uses physical bodies, but I don't think you have to have a physical body to be conscious. And so I just have reached a point in my life where, because of all this, I do think that there are entities out there, benign and otherwise, and you know, it's just part of the game that we've got to play. I don't think they're responsible for everything that humans do to each other, but I don't know. At the same time, I've dealt with poltergeist type activity. You know, I've had things fly off shelves. I've had car alarms go off near me. I sneezed once and almost started my car. So it freaked my buddy out. He saw it happen. He's like, "Did you just see that?" I'm like, "What? The lights just went up. The lights just came on and went off when you sneezed." I'm like, "Wow, I must have quite a cold. I don't know."
That's fantastic.
But I can't control any of it. I don't. Yeah. I'd love to start my own psychic hotline and make some real money, but it doesn't seem to work that way.
Now, do you think that the positive negative entity thing? Do you think that is a matter of perspective, or that these things, or is there some inherent evil in the world?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. You know, I just when I was a kid, what I've noticed is that when I was a child, me and my brother were attacked regularly by some sort of poltergeist type activity, and I think that they were demons. I think there was some intelligence that particularly just didn't like me and my brother, and probably a lot of other people. And there's a lot of things that happened, and it kind of went away. Like one time when I was 12, I mean, it was just the strangest thing. I was 12 years old, and I went down to my basement to do some laundry, and the lights went off by themselves, and this giant growl, you know, erupted from the darkness, and it sounded like a combination of different animals, not just like one animal. And I ran up the stairs. I never told anybody, because I was so terrified of that event. But I mean, it could have been a raccoon, you know, but I don't know how he turned off the lights at the same time he was growling at me. So I don't know, you know, like that's happened, and just a ton of other stuff has happened. And I have a feeling that whatever consciousness is, it's a lot of things. And if I'm an individual and part of the one, as they call it, I just think there's probably other things too. And for whatever reason, my suspicion, and based upon what I experienced as a child and what I've experienced since, is that there are intelligences somewhere out there in the universe or inner universe or whatever that seem to prey parasitically upon trauma and negative emotions. that's kind of my belief now. And I guess Christians call them demons. They might be the same thing as certain aliens. I use the Greys, you know, as an example, but I don't know what the Greys really are. I don't know if they're truly demons or if they're actual nice guys. I don't really know. But I do know. I would say I know, you know, and I don't expect everyone to want to believe me or care, but I definitely believe now, I'm pretty 100% certain that intelligence can fracture, and there are parasitical things out there or energies of some kind that are able to attach themselves to people and manipulate events in some way.
Hmm. We actually had just recorded last night, it is not up yet, but a show on night terrors and sleep paralysis where we address some of these issues and whether these things are purely negative or, you know, coming from within us outwardly or what. And a lot of the sleep paralysis, night terror stuff, people who have them will tell you that they seem like they're entities.
Yeah.
And that they're very malignant.
Yeah.
Have you ever had any experiences with those?
Yeah, I have. And so I'm sort of 50-50 on that, because I believe some of that is just an internal struggle. You know, mm-hmm. I've had moments, for years I woke up screaming, trying to fight what I thought was something on top of me, trying to hurt me and whatnot. So I've definitely had that experience. But I've also had experiences where I've been completely awake and things have happened, you know. So I wonder, you know, I think the problem with consciousness and how we try to understand it is it's a very, once you start getting in past the rational mind, you start getting into the unconscious mind, it's like stepping into a giant swamp, and a lot of things are very porous, you know, and it's really hard to define what the dividing lines are between you and someone else and, you know, this other dimension that might have this, the other thing in it. But I don't know. I think when people are experiencing those things, I think what's happening to them is they're starting to wake up. You know, they're starting to, the boundaries in their own unconscious mind are becoming more open and porous, and trying to navigate this, what the Greeks called hell. You know, I mean, if you look at what ancient civilizations talked about when it came to the unconscious mind and the dream world and Hades, it's really just that unconscious part of ourselves. It's a wild beast. That's an unknown element to a lot of our more rational sides of thinking, and it requires a descent, you know, into it. And when you go into that place, it's hard to track what the hell's happening. I you know, I don't know. I would say that once you're in that dream world, anything can happen. You can wind up having encounters with beings that are foreign to you, and you can just as well have your own inner demons that are not, you know, anything separate from you, all in the same day, you know. So it's kind of it's really hard for me to pinpoint, you know, what's completely external and what's internal. I just know that consciousness as we understand it is not understood in any way, you know, that anybody can definitively say we have it figured out, because we just don't.
I would fully agree with that, actually. Yeah. And that's the thing. A lot of this stuff, I mean, like poltergeist phenomena, you said you had some of that, and a lot of that is, most parapsychologists will attribute that to spontaneous PK coming from children around the age of puberty.
Well, you know, it happened to me really badly around a girl who was very psychologically disturbed. She's a relative of mine that I went to live with for a period of time, and all of that stuff just completely ramped up around her. It was really crazy, and she even saw it. Even the guy at the Lowe's saw it. We were at the Lowe's buying some liquid Drano for a plugged-up toilet, and as we were walking down the aisle, a big jar of Drano flies off the shelf. And the Lowe's guy walks over and he jokes, "Oh, it must be the ghost of Lowe's." And he puts it back on the shelf.
Nice.
I mean, the problem with all of this stuff that I always run into, I guess, with skeptics, it's like I don't have a team of Harvard psychologists and parapsychologists towing around with me everywhere I go. I mean, I can't document all this. I wish I could.
Sure,
but
sure.
It happens, you know. And, you know, you just don't have a choice after a while but to try and open your mind a little bit, because what else are you going to do?
What kind of experiences, when we were talking about the night terrors, you said you had some experiences in fully awake consciousness like that?
Yeah, you know, what happens to me every now and then is, you know, I think the most profound thing that happened to me in the last couple of years was I had this, I went out, so I remember I told you about the growl that happened, this growl. Well, that growl came back one day. I was in my backyard and I heard that growl. And I thought, well, maybe it's a bear, maybe it's a raccoon. I was living in a pretty rural part of Washington State. I remember that growl pretty distinctly because it was pretty frightening. And then that same day or the next day after that, I kept getting a lot of knocking, a lot of TVs coming on and off, a lot of tapping at the window. It woke up me and my girlfriend, you know, and she said it was probably just a squirrel, you know, trying to get in. But I'm like, I don't know. I mean, it's a lot of tapping, a lot of knocking. I would answer the door. And then one day while I was on my bed, and this is just after I had had testicular cancer, something grabbed my groin. Like, it just full-on grabbed it, and I couldn't see anything. And it hurt like hell. And the first time it happened, I thought maybe it's just a phantom pain, like it's something that is a leftover from the surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And then it happened again. And then I'm like, okay, so whatever this thing is, it's growling at me, it's tapping, it's trying to basically intimidate me in some way with fear. And I realized this was the same thing, I think, that was affecting me and my brother when we were young, because we had very similar types of phenomenon happen. So, you know, I talked to my guru, said some prayers, did some, you know, mental concentration exercises, did some things to try and, like, you know, keep my fear to a minimum. And it seemed to go away, although it was kind of always around as well. So, you know, I mean, luckily for me, the night terrors have stopped. And I'm sort of at a place now where if something's going to happen, it happens in my waking life mostly. I'll make this really quick, but the most phenomenal thing that really ever happened to me was two Easters ago. And it's funny we're talking about this now because this is about the same night. In fact, what is tonight? Is tonight Saturday?
Yeah. Yeah.
And is tomorrow Sunday, Easter?
Yes, it is.
So this is really serendipitous because this is the same time that this happened 2 years ago that I'm talking to you about it now. I was on the road to our home for Easter Sunday. It was a Saturday night. And as I was driving, this person was standing on the side of the road by a mailbox. And I had to pull around the person to not hit them. And my girlfriend was asking me, What are you doing? I'm like, well, I don't want to hit this guy who's out here checking his mail at 10 at night. And she's like, what guy? I'm like, whatever. And she's like, no, I don't see him. I'm like, well, by then I'd driven past him. So I kind of just blew it off. She just didn't see him, you know. Well, then I take a left turn maybe half a mile later to get to our house, the road to our house, and I see someone dressed just like that guy again. But instead of standing on the side of the road staring at me, he's walking away from me. And I'm like, and I just kind of casually blurt out, what's the deal with all these people walking around Easter Eve, you know, in a very rural part of town? And she's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, seriously, you're going to do this again? And she's like, no, I don't see what you're talking about. I mean, so now I'm freaking out. I'm worried now because I'm seeing stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And I won't shut up about it. She gets really annoyed. And in the middle of the night, two things happen in the middle of the night. One, in the middle of the night, the first thing that happened is a hand hits me in the forehead out of nowhere. As I'm sleeping, and I wake up, and I'm sure it was like in a dream state, of course, but it was so powerful that I got out of bed. I thought someone was in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, now my girlfriend's thinking I'm clinically insane. I try to go back to bed, and then within another 5-10 minutes before I fully fall asleep again, I have this, I would call it an out-of-body experience, where I am pushing on the pedal, on the brake pedal of a car, trying to stop the car before getting into a serious accident. And it freaks me out so bad that I get up again out of bed and I go to the window to check to see if our house had been, a car had crashed into our house. And after all this is said and done, we wake up in the morning, she kicks me out of the house. She says, this is it, no Easter for you. You're insane, go get out of here. So, and it was a bad fight. I don't want to get into specifics, but we really had a nasty fight. So I go, well, it's time for a coffee. You know, I need to get my coffee if I'm going to have to plan the rest of my life. So I'll make this quick. But as I was driving, so I start driving to get my coffee. And the place where I saw the guy the second time, the mysterious man, whoever he was actually right across from where I get my coffee. But it was closed. But as I pull in there, the owner shows up out of nowhere. And I ask him, are you open? He's like, no, I'm just grabbing some milk. So I drive off. And I'm not exaggerating. Within seconds, at the same spot I saw the guy the first time by the mailbox, a car hits another car, crashes right into it.
Oh.
And I pull over, I take some photos, I go, do you see this? This is where I saw that guy the night before. And if I hadn't pulled into my coffee stand for that 5 seconds, I would have been in the spot that car was in when it crashed into this car. And turned out it injured a small boy, and I didn't have insurance at the time. So to this day, it's just the weirdest thing ever. It haunts me to this day that I don't know what these things were on the side of the road. The only thing it kind of brings to mind is the Mothman sort of story, where you have like these things that I think feed on negative events. And I was just lucky enough to have, I guess, seen them. Although the accident I saw myself getting into was the accident that I could have gotten into. And it's just, it's to this day, it's still like, it bends my mind, because it really taught me that what we call time is, I wouldn't say it's the constant we think it is. I think there are certain ways around it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it also could have been a premonition to make sure you didn't have the accident.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I'm still trying to figure it all out. And the other thing, too, is the guy was dressed just like my barista the next day. So there's a lot of things that I don't get. It might have been just a marker of some kind, and I'm still trying to, you know, interpret all that. But that's the most powerful moment, the most powerful thing that's ever happened to me, because I saw those guys, you know. It wasn't like I thought I saw somebody, or I was half asleep when I saw them. But I saw them, you know. And right. for the physical eyes to see that, it still unsettles me, you know.
All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Richard Craner.
Where Did the Road Go can be heard first and usually live on WVBR, Saturday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern. Go to wheredidtheroadgo.com to ask questions of our live guests through the chat room. Where Did the Road Go is then re-aired on Dark Matter Radio and Deprogrammed Radio. You can download all shows for free on the website, and you can subscribe to us on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, or Vimeo. Additional content can be found on our video channels. You will also find our upcoming schedule, book reviews, blogs, free book downloads, links, and more. We are also on Facebook and Twitter, and if you want to help support the show, there are links to donate to us. Everything you need can be found at wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And, of course, we also have a Patreon now. If you want to get some extra content here and there, little extra bits I do with different guests and some extra stuff we're going to throw out, as well as some cheaper merch to patrons, hopefully very soon. We're working on the merch at the moment. I also set up a forum on wheredidtheroadgo.com, so you can go there and comment on things that are already there, or add your own subjects, suggest guests, do whatever you want. And I added a group on Facebook as well, if that's your preference. And tonight we're talking with Richard Craner. And initially, we were talking about your movie Starleaf.
Yeah.
But I want to get into some more of your experiences here, because these are very interesting. The out-of-body experiences, what happened there?
Well, it all started, the first one I ever had that was intense was, I think I was probably 25. Again, it was when I first started meditating. And I was just in my bed one night, and I tried to roll over in the sheets, but I rolled over inside my own body instead. And that was freaky. So I was turned, my face was down in the bed, but my face was actually looking up at the ceiling, and it hurt a little. I remember it being painful, like I ripped something when I did it. And then I popped out, and I floated about at the top of the ceiling for a while, and I was just like, what in the F? You know, I couldn't believe it. And then bam, it was over. But it was shocking, you know, it was really something surreal. But the two most profound ones happened, I've only had, I'd say, like three or four major of those types of events. But the second time it happened was the most profound, because when I was a kid, I would walk around with my top button always buttoned around my collar. I didn't like anyone seeing my neck. And I didn't like my neck being exposed. And I did this until I was about 7 years old. And there's a lot of pictures of me when I was that young looking ridiculous with this top button always buttoned. And, you know, my dad would yell at me as I was walking to school, telling me to unbutton the shirt, you know. But I found out why. Because as I was going through Kundalini, there was a day when I was just on my bed and I wasn't doing anything special. I was just kind of sitting there, I think, getting ready to go somewhere. And in front of my third eye, or right in front of me, just the room disappeared, and these strange letters just sort of magically appeared in front of me. And I don't know what language they are. They looked like some sort of angelic script, but it was almost like winning a jackpot at a casino. They just kind of came down in succession. And then when they cleared, I was in a cave. And the first thing I remember about the cave experience was that things were getting knocked over. Like, just you could hear things breaking, like just incense holders and things like that. People screaming. And then three Asian guys come running around the corner, and one of them's got a knife, and they tackle me, and they start cutting my head off. And then that's all of a sudden, boom, I'm back in my body going, what the heck happened? And for the next couple of days, you know, I would have just this feeling of someone grabbing my hair and yanking on it and trying to cut my head off.
Wow.
And it was really intense. And this isn't like a dream. This wasn't, it's what they would call visions or out of body experiences, where you just leave, your consciousness leaves the body it's in right now and goes to some other place. I think that was the moment where my being just decided that, because of what Kundalini does, which is try to clear all your trauma and your karma, basically, I had some sort of deep attachment to that experience. I had some deep-seated fear, and rightfully so.
Right.
I had my head cut off. So we keep these – what I learned from this experience is that we keep our traumas from lifetime to lifetime. And it basically proved to me that reincarnation exists. It's sort of why I can believe it 100%. And some people don't have to believe. Trust me, that maybe I have a shy neck. But when I had that experience coupled with what I had as a kid, it started to kind of dawn on me that this is probably what this is. It's a leftover artifact. And I've done a lot of research since. I forget the guy's name, but there was a scientist who actually went to Southeast Asia, and he studied reincarnation. In that environment, it's easier to access those memories and prove it with objective proof, because there's no shame in believing that, you know. So the mind stay open longer, and it's easier to actually get evidence. And then the last time that anything that really happened was when I had testicular cancer, and I had just had a surgery that was really a brutal surgery. They collapsed both of my lungs, and they removed tumors from my lungs. And I couldn't sleep for 5 days, so it kind of created like this vision quest almost, you know, a westernized version of it, where you don't sleep, you don't eat, and I was just losing my mind. But that's exactly, I guess, what it takes. And one day I just kind of left my body, and I was flying through the clouds, and I heard a voice say, you're going to go back down, and don't be afraid. And then I just found myself shooting down towards the ocean, and when I hit the ocean, I didn't splatter. It absorbed me, and then I was back in my friend's living room. But these things aren't like when I talk about them, it's just really hard to share, because I know the difference between a daydream. I know the difference between hallucination. I wasn't smoking anything, you know? So, you know, I when people talk about these experiences themselves, I can relate, you know? I mean, I sometimes wonder if it's 100% true, but I know it's possible for people to have them, because I've had them.
Right. And when you talk about the reincarnation, the thing that has interested me most is when children can spontaneously recall past lives, especially to such detail that they can be verified. Because when you have a 2 or 3 year old, they haven't been exposed to stuff where they could have made it up. You know, it's just they're just, and then they forget it as they get older. And I mean, that may be a cultural thing. It's entirely possible. But to me, that is one of the weightier pieces of evidence for reincarnation, is when children can just spout this stuff off, stuff they don't even really understand.
Yeah. They don't have the filter ingrained yet in them, because that porous part of their mind at that age, I think they've done studies on it where they've analyzed kids' brains, and so they're still operating very much in the unconscious space, because they got to assimilate information about their environment very quickly. But that leaves them open to the unconscious space, which I think transcends just this dimension right now. And that's why I think they still have access to those impressions or those memories. And there's like you're saying, there is a phenomenal amount of actual research out there and scientific studies that have kids, you know, actually, you know, I think there's been a couple cases where there's been like murders, you know, solved.
Right.
The kid points to where a body's buried. I mean, these aren't just random woo-woo things. I mean, you can do the research on this stuff and find out that it happens. And it really helps when your culture doesn't, you know, poo-poo it. And then that way, I think the doorways in the unconscious, they open longer. But just like me, I forgot about it after a while. I stopped thinking about why my neck, you know, because my regular life kicked in. I had other priorities, you know, and I just kind of, as you turn 7 or 8 years of age, your mind starts to harden, you know. It starts to become more operating off of, you know, automatic, you know, reactions. Your ego has started to shell itself. And
right.
Now needs to interact with this life right now. But while you're at that age, yeah, I totally think that that's where a lot of the research needs to keep happening.
The other possibility, of course, is that we're tuning into some kind of Akashic record type of thing where all these lives are there and we're focusing in on one for one reason or another.
I definitely know that. I think now when I had that first experience with my head being cut off, maybe it's not mine or not, I don't know, but that was me getting hacking in somehow.
Yeah.
I really think that that's what those letters were. They were sort of like this language that stores the universe's information in it. And I didn't even know what the Akashic records were until a couple of years after that happened. And I started doing some research. I mean, I really fought my Kundalini. I really didn't like it.
No, it's not pleasant.
No, a lot of people want to have spiritual experiences, but they don't really understand, like, You basically have to leave Kansas for good the minute you start really getting in touch with that stuff. It's going to have its own idea about what your spiritual journey is going to be. And so you have to be open to that. And it's hard for some people. Hard for me.
It takes you where you need to go, not where you think you want to go.
Absolutely. That is the most important thing anybody needs to know right there.
And whether it's ayahuasca or Kundalini or whatever, that's what's going to happen. You don't do it for recreation.
You don't. Absolutely.
Obviously, if you can do Kundalini yoga and get it to work, at least you're not breaking any laws at this point.
Yeah, and the Kundalini yoga, I think for some, the only apprehension I have about Kundalini yoga is I don't think some people realize what they're doing when they do that. Like you are going to have to at some point, if you start really triggering it to be quite active, you're going to, again, leave Kansas. So yeah. To me, it's not something, if you want to get a stretch in, you know, do some Hatha yoga. But if you're going to do Kundalini yoga, take your time and work up to it so that the energy can flow through. Because for me, what the problem was, I was drinking at the time. I was partying too much. I was doing a lot of other, I hate to say it, illicit activities. I wasn't a good person. And so all that positive energy hit a lot of negative energy. And that's when, you know, the sparks flew and my life went off the rails. But I think if you approach the path with a little bit more respect and honor, and you take your time with this stuff, you don't try to go rushing for the quick spiritual fix, but you build up to it. You're not going to break something. Where some people do break. I mean, there are stories in India of people going to India and just, you know, not being able to handle it.
No, it can drive you insane.
It can drive you insane for sure.
Did it change your like you as a person when this happened?
Yeah. I mean, I'm definitely the thing that I remember talking to somebody about this, and they asked me, "What is it? Has it made you enlightened?" You know, and what it did for me, and what it's still doing for me, is I don't know if my path is enlightened. I have a feeling that I've got some other journey. But what it has done is cleared a lot of debris that was anchoring me to a very false sense of self and a false sense of reality. And it's ongoing. But the thing about it that's fascinating about it is I'm just not addicted to anything. I'm not angry like some people are, you know.
Right.
I'm passionate, but it's almost as if someone just poured a bunch of Roto-Rooter down the drain and cleared out anything that was of a real hindrance. And I still feel like it's operating and clearing things and you know, incubating still. But the really nasty things that trap people in life, things that warp their sense of what they can be and who they are. Luckily, the Kundalini for me cleared a lot of that. And then it left behind, I guess, some cities, you know, city. I guess it's what the Hindus call some kind of powers. And I don't want to go there to the point where I can predict or plan anything, but I definitely have had experiences now since then that I can't deny are somehow paranormal, and it's a part of our universe, and I don't know how it works 100%, and I can't enforce it, but when it does happen, it leaves me humbled, because now I get it. Now I get that the universe is a lot bigger place than I can track.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Well, I think it's a bit bigger than we can conceive. And I mean, when we talk about other things being out there, we perceive so little of the universe, like not even just space-wise, but just like, you know, we see such a small spectrum. We hear such a small spectrum. I mean, things could exist entirely outside those spectrums that we'd never know were there.
And you know, I'll say one more thing too, that the most important thing, the legacy that the Kundalini has left behind, is a very sober appreciation for love. Mm-hmm. And for the how to empower and how to not abuse power. I think that's, if anything, that the Kundalini experience has left for me is how important love is, how not to hold it hostage, how not to manipulate it. And because the repercussions of doing that are so severe. The pain I've been through, that I've either been inflicted upon or I've inflicted upon others, and to see that cascade out into governments and countries and other things, you realize how important it is for all of us to process and not be trapped in this fear-based mindset anymore. And of course, you have to go through fear to overcome it. Yeah. And it's not like I'm not afraid of things. I don't particularly want to experience pain, but I also know that when push comes to shove, you have to choose love. You have to choose to not be afraid, and that's the thing that I always give credit to Kundalini for. It just removed all of the stupid blinders and stupid I would say conditionings that, you know, I had about what I should expect and what I'm entitled to and what I think love should be. It's like, whatever, dude. You know, you're an idiot. Now you know, and so do something with it, and don't be an idiot anymore.
And the thing is, Kundalini's never quite done with you.
Yeah, I definitely have to be careful because I keep thinking, okay, am I done? Am I done? I'm like, no, there's still another level that we got to go through here, Rich. And I think the only thing that I'm blessed with now is that really dark phase that where you're really not in tune. You're totally. Yeah. I'm screwing off. I'm not eating right. I'm not having the right relationships. If I don't misbehave, it doesn't kick me in the butt as much.
see, with me, it was completely spontaneous. I never did yoga or anything. I hit around 12 or 13, and it just spontaneously started hitting me. And
wow.
I went through years and years of not knowing what was going on and thinking I was going crazy and everything else.
That's common. Yeah.
And if anyone missed the show I did on that probably about a year and a half ago now, you can just search the website, wheretheroadgo.com. Just put Kundalini in the search box. It should come up. And you can also find it on YouTube if you're interested.
I want to watch it because I thought I was the only guy going through it.
Right.
I was super special and I was the only person ever. And the more I go on YouTube and I see like all kinds of different people out there going, what's going on? Like, wow, it's actually becoming more and more common. And I feel less and less, you know, awkward about it because I'm like, no, this is actually a pretty common phenomenon now in the universe. I mean, I don't know if it's common, but it's not, you know, definitely not the only ones who've experienced it.
No. And Kundalini's in everyone. It's part of you. It's just not awake in most people.
Right. Right.
And I found that if you're around the right people, either they already have it slightly awake or it wakes up in them. If you like gel with them a certain way.
You know, my wife at the time didn't have it. And you know what happened after about me having an active one for about 9 months? It jump started in her. And it completely freaked her out. She was I have video footage of her on the floor just convulsing on the floor. Yeah. And she's not in any kind of psychological pain or physical pain, but she can't control her body. It's almost like you turn on a garden hose that hasn't been turned on in like, you know, 10 years and it's coiled up and you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it just shoots up. That's kind of what Kundalini does to some people when it awakens in a way that it wants to. Because you can't, like I said, you can't really control it. And you just got to hope that it'll give you some space to process. But it could be a bumpy ride and you really can't do anything about it.
And it also gets mistaken for epilepsy for that very reason sometimes.
Oh, I bet. I bet. I think the number one thing the number one differentiator between Kundalini and permanent psychosis and permanent physiological disabilities is usually what happens is it stops and it changes into something else. It's sort of and then you get worse for a while, but then you realize it's sort of resetting your bad stuff and purging. And then because like when I was going through it, I tried to monitor it. I said to my wife, you know, this continues, you're going to have to take me to the psych ward. Yeah. But after 3 days, maybe a week of really intense purging, I was actually better than where I was when I started. So it's I think that's the thing. You actually get better with Kundalini in the long run. You become more loving. You become more sober. So more realistic or capable, I think, of tuning into your truth. Whereas if it's true schizophrenia, you're just going to get worse and worse.
True. Well, we're getting near the end of the show here. Let's talk about the movie a little bit more.
Okay.
So the movie is Starleaf, and it deals with a lot of the stuff we're talking about right here, about delving into yourself and dealing with blocks and stuff. But it does so in a sci-fi, humorous sci-fi manner. It's not a comedy.
Yeah.
But it definitely has its sense of humor in there.
Yeah. Well, that's something my guru told me, that the only way you're going to survive this is if you develop a sense of humor.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I always figure it works like this. The universe has a sense of humor. You can either laugh along with it or be the butt of its jokes, but it's going to do what it wants.
That's exactly it. You gotta grow up and laugh along and enjoy the ride as much as you can. That's totally true. There's somebody who said something about humor being how you fight back, you know, against life when it's not going your way. It's how your spirit, you know, assimilates life difficulties, because most of the comedians out there are tragic in some way. You know, it's some sort of way, I think, that you continue the trend of turning the dark into light. And so it's just something that I think it's not a comedy, but humor is just a big part of getting to the truth sometimes.
And how long did it take you to film this?
We shot it in 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
And, well, actually, it was 16, 17 days. And I spent the last year, the next year, basically just editing the film, trying to get it all finished. And then we've been, for the last, maybe since November, officially releasing it and trying to get it out to the world.
All right. And this, what was the budget on it?
Let's see. Okay, so I think I can come out and admit it finally, because I wasn't supposed to say what it was for a long time. I think it's $40,000, something like that. Yeah, $40,000 and another bunch of thousands for the marketing and other things. Yeah.
Right. Where'd you shoot it?
I lived in Paulsbo, Washington, which is kind of near where they shot a lot of the Twilight films, or where the Twilight films were supposedly set, in the Olympic Peninsula. And I had 7 acres in my backyard, so a lot of that stuff was just backyard shooting. And then we drive to the coast. We drive to different locations that had lots of woods, and we just sort of guerrilla styled it.
Huh. All right. Yeah. Well, that works.
Well, the trees are their own sort of production design. You don't have to pay to go build a bunch of trees and castles, and the trees are trees. They're already there, and you just have to. So I tried to work with what nature was already giving me.
Well, you definitely have some weird trees in here, which I'm assuming were all made up.
No, that's the other thing. So I was on a location scout, and that pod forest is real.
Really?
And I saw that. I'm like, you're kidding me. Nobody's ever thought of shooting here. And so that wasn't even in the script. But when I saw that stuff, I was like, you know what? I got to put this in the movie, because it's going to give us great production value. And nature gave it to us for free.
That is awesome, because that definitely looks like an alien landscape.
When I saw it, I couldn't believe it. I was like, this is just money. You know, this is awesome.
All right. And this is available where?
If you go on right now, I think iTunes has it, Google Play. It's pretty – YouTube carries it now on YouTube Red. So all those platforms are there. There's Amazon. You can buy the DVD on Amazon. And we're coming to Hulu and Amazon Prime here shortly as well.
Nice. And what's up next?
We're trying to do Starleaf 2. We're trying to do a short miniseries that we can probably get on one of these networks. And Rise of the Archon. We're going to talk about how the aliens now are going to use a GMO company to hijack the Starleaf genome and use it as a backdoor into people's consciousness.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. All right, we'll see how that goes.
did you write the entire script for Starleaf?
I wrote the first 3 drafts, and then I brought in a guy named Hugh Barry, who really knew how to add some great humor. And he added, he called out a couple of big problems we had. We didn't have a high scene where nobody actually got high in the movie. And I was like, he's like, dude, you got to have people getting actually high on this stuff. You can't make a weed film about that. It's like, duh. So he helped out with that. And he was a great addition to the writing process.
Nice. Are you happy with it?
I am. The only thing, you know, I when I see it, I'd love to go back and probably add a couple more big action scenes. I'd probably like to expand a couple things. But I think it is what it is, and I'm pretty happy with it. I look forward to an opportunity to go deeper, you know, because we were limited with the aliens. You know, I couldn't do as many scary things with the aliens as I wanted to. I couldn't do a lot of night shots. So, of course, I'd like to ramp that up. But I'm glad that it's a story-driven and a character-driven vehicle as opposed to a big special effect thing.
Oh, yeah, because that's what made it interesting to me. It was actually, right. And it was kind of messed with your head because you didn't know what was real and what was not. And it made you question, like you should with reality, what does real mean?
Yeah, and I think that's what's so fun about if I could do a sequel is that we can explore that further and keep the audience, build the appreciation for the film from the engagement that people have philosophically with it, and not so much that they're being, you know, overwhelmed by special effects. I mean, I think having more of those is not a bad idea, but really the kind of stuff you can tackle with Starleaf is pretty in depth, and I want to continue to do it.
Cool. Do you have a web presence anywhere?
Yeah, if you go on starleafmovie.com, that's where our film's website is, and that goes out to our Twitter and our Facebook. And I need to get my own website back up and running eventually as well. But yeah, so starleafmovie.com, though, is probably the best way to get a hold of me.
Okay, and you said you've done a few movies before this, but nothing quite on this level?
Yeah, this is the first time that I think I made something that really, you know, was a reflection of my own personal... Oh, it was a film called God Machine that's actually kind of a cool short film that we made about an android that channels the frequency of the Big Bang. Hmm. That's on, I think, IndieFlix, and it might be out there in some other places. And we're hoping to maybe make a feature out of that as well. I've also got this script about a family of German werewolves that fight the Nazis during World War II, and it deals with the Anunnabe, which were the occult division of the SS. So I'm pitching those things as well to try to get them going. But yeah, there's a few other things that I've done, but Starleaf is the one, I think, where everything really came together in the best way.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you for spending some time with us and talking to us about your experiences.
I want to go look up your experiences now. I'm going to YouTube it.
And I think anytime someone does that, you know, talks about their experiences, it helps other people who may not know that there are other people going through this out there. You know, I mean, that was my problem. I went through all this pre-internet, so I didn't have a means of just looking. I found it serendipitously in Fate magazine with a list of Kundalini symptoms and went, whoa, hey.
Well, you're braver than I, because I don't know how I would have survived without the internet. I was freaking out, and I like what you said, because I feel like I'm starting to come out of the Kundalini closet, because I'm not going to lie to you, I was never ashamed of it, but I always had a hard time explaining it to people, because I always had a problem as a kid wanting to fit in. I was a Jehovah's Witness. I always felt kind of weird because I couldn't celebrate holidays. So I've always suffered from this compulsion to want to fit in, and I'm glad now that that's kind of that unhealthy aspect of my thinking is going away.
Yeah. And I never really talked about it because it was so personal in so many different ways.
Yeah, I bet.
But again, the opportunity to let people know out there that, hey, you're not alone. Other people have been through this, and it will be okay as long as you stop fighting it, really.
No, that's the number one thing. I screwed up on that. That was my big mistake. Don't fight it. Accept it. It's trying to help you. It's trying to make your life wonderful, really, you know. So don't fight it.
All right. Well, thank you, Richard. We're going to end with some Mechanism off their new EP, The Shift, because I think the consciousness metaphors are good in here. And yeah. We're going to hear Mouth of God, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you, Soraya.
seats of consciousness. I remember a time I was dead before I was born. The legend inside us, the spirit reminds us from the memory.